The preliminary remarks have already reminded us that our study today is related to an actuality, because the well-known sentences of which we were reminded, such as "Theosophist is who Theosophy does," tend to this. The devotional reading was chosen with the thought that wherever we may stand, we meaning students of Theosophy, workers for Theosophy, at whatever point on our individual roads of evolution we may stand, either it is somewhere on the road of bhakti or devotion, or we have simply lost our way. Whatever else we go into, in the way of discussion as to technical points, bits of knowledge which we have or do not have, whatever limitations we may have as to understanding the more subtle tenets of Theosophy, either we are somewhere on the path of devotion, even if we are making stumbling steps at its very beginning, that is all right, but we are on that path, or we're not going towards Theosophy at all. And in any case, that chapter has valuable instruction to give us. Now, you know that there is an article by HPB. In fact, she published it in the very first volume, the first issue of The Theosophist. What are the Theosophists? And the first sentence of that article is, "Are they what they claim to be?" A daunting phrase that our teacher and guru should have become, that article by saying, "Are they what they claim to be?" But however, we learn from seeing what she says they claim to be, what Theosophists claim to be. One aspect of it is obviously students of natural law, of ancient and modern philosophy, and even of exact science. And she recalls Ammonius Saccas, the 3rd century Neoplatonist and Theosophist who gave us the word Theosophy in Greek. And she says that we remember his object, which was to make nations remember that they are the children of one mother. Now, "of one mother" is in quotation marks there, because apparently this was a phrase used by Ammonius Saccas. That universal attitude in studying seems to be regarded by HPB as fundamental to the idea of a Theosophist. Not at the, shall we say, the level of beginning, but much later on the path, one also thinks of the kinds of questions that Arjuna asks, not in the reading which we had today, but much earlier in chapter 2, you remember. Arjuna asked Krishna about the Sthita Prajna. And what he said was, "What, O Keshava, is the description of that wise and devoted man who is fixed in contemplation and confirmed in spiritual knowledge?" All that is Mr. Judge's paraphrase of the term Sthita Prajna. "What may such a sage declare? Where may he dwell? Does he move and act like other men?" And "what may such a sage declare?" You will remember that in the original, the word vadet is used. What does he say? If you want to be literal. Now, obviously, a Theosophist is not necessarily, in fact, seldom a Sthita Prajna. But we might ask the same sort of questions, just as Arjuna asked them, and try among ourselves to answer these questions in deciding what is a Theosophist. In the preliminary remarks, it was pointed out that we might say, who is a Theosophist? And the expression, "Theosophist is who Theosophy does," was recalled. Also, what is a Theosophist might mean, how do we distinguish the Theosophist? How do we define the Theosophist? What's the idea represented by the word Theosophist? all those implications are there in the word ought. And just as Sthita Prajna is far away, there is another concept, the Christian concept of the man reborn in Christ. There again, we are not speaking of somebody just beginning. But it's a very interesting pointer, and we should like to read you a description, especially because it's a description in very simple words by a Christian scholar of what he thinks a man really reborn in Christ would be like. He says, already the new men, by the new men he means men reborn in Christ. Already the new men are dotted here and there all over the earth. Some, as I have admitted, are still hardly recognizable because they're just beginning. But others can be recognized. Every now and then one meets them. Their very voices and faces are different from ours. Stronger, quieter, happier, more radiant. They begin where most of us leave off. They are, I say, recognizable. But you must know what to look for. They will not be very like the idea of religious people which you have formed from your general reading. They do not draw attention to themselves. You tend to think that you are being kind to them when they are really being kind to you. They love you more than other men do, but they need you less. We must get over wanting to be needed. In some goodish people, that is the hardest of all temptations to resist. They will usually seem to have a lot of time. You will wonder where it comes from. When you have recognized one of them, you will recognize the next one much more easily. And I strongly suspect, but how should I know, that they recognize one another immediately and infallibly across every barrier of color, sex, class, age, and even of creeds. In that way, to become holy is rather like joining a secret society. Obviously, this scholar, out of sheer sincerity, has gone far beyond the beginnings of becoming a sincere Christian. But this description of what a reborn man would be like is relevant in the sense that this is not what every theosophist claims to be or what we claim that every theosophist is, but this sort of defines the direction, the ultimate ideal, just as the Sthita Prajna defines another and deep aspect of that ideal. Why are we speaking of ideals? Because to be a theosophist at all must imply, if the word means anything, that theosophy is a very strong and real factor in the nature and life of a theosophist. I mean, if it is not, why use the word? You just be like anybody else. A normal man of the 20th century, which is not a very flattering thing to say about anyone, but that is what would happen. The difference, after all, must be theosophy. You know, Aristotle once said that to define something you have to say genus and differentia. You have to say what broad class something belongs to, and then say how it is different. Now, we won't worry about defining a broad class, but let's see what is definite about the student of theosophy. Now, there again, in that same article to which we referred, what are the theosophists, Madame Blavatsky said something very interesting. For to be one, by one, in the context, one means theosophist. To be a theosophist, one need not necessarily recognize the existence of any special god or a deity. One need but worship the spirit of living nature and try to identify oneself with it. To revere that presence, the invisible cause, which is yet ever manifesting itself in its incessant results. The intangible, omnipotent and omnipresent Proteus, indivisible in its essence, an eluding form, yet appearing under all and every form, who is here and there and everywhere and nowhere, is all and nothing, ubiquitous yet one, the essence filling, binding, bounding, containing everything, contained in all. It will, we think, be seen now that whether classed as theists, pantheists or atheists, such men are near kinsmen to the rest. Be what he may, once that a student abandons the old and trodden highway of routine and enters upon the solitary paths of independent thought, Godward, he is a theosophist, an original thinker, a seeker after the eternal truth with an inspiration of his own to solve the universal problems. That's on page 5 in our ULT pamphlet number 22. Now, this is very interesting. You can see that at once, she is defining a very broad and deep philosophical position, and at the same time, in the same sentence, saying that the label doesn't matter. That he might be called a theist, he might be called a pantheist, he might even be called an atheist. It doesn't matter. Then what is it that matters? That he is sincerely and, as it were, on his own responsibility, seeking to find the truth, honestly, Godward, that he started out on a kind of solitary journey, Godward. And she implies that he will get an inspiration of his own. That is to say, sooner or later, the inspiration will come from within. It doesn't matter which defined creed he accepts. We notice the Christian scholar saying, astonishingly, that the holy people recognize one another across all differences of creeds. So this universality is a characteristic of spiritual development from a certain level onwards. But it is part of the definition of a theosophist. Now, mind you, in fact, within the history of the theosophical movement, there were such things as subgroups of theosophists who were all Hindus or all Christians or all Zoroastrians, and they were permitted to carry on their rather special study of that tradition, and permitted or even encouraged to place before, as she says in another place, an independent world, place before a world as impartially as possible what they had found in their own tradition, so long as they did not force it upon anyone or demand that anybody else should accept it. But this is a kind of preliminary stage, because theosophy itself always has existed on two levels. There is the theosophy itself, in the sense, for example, she gives it in the conclusion to the Key to Theosophy, where she says, oh, that is simply synonymous with everlasting truths, which is a devastating statement, because elsewhere she has also explained that on this earth, none of us is likely to possess the whole truth. She has added, beings from other worlds may possess it entire, we can only get approximations. She's been very clear about all that. Therefore, she's not at all saying that the books and expressions which are available within the theosophical movement are everlasting truth. But she's saying that theosophy itself is everlasting truth. And of course she has explained, particularly in the secret doctrine, most students are familiar with the passage called the ancient source, that it exists in that sense only in the custody of those who are spiritually perfected, those who can directly perceive by their own spiritual experience what the truth is, and they agree among themselves. Naturally, because if you see accurately, you agree. But when it comes to expression, when it comes to exposition, explanation, then there are many differences according to time and culture and nation and so on. So this idea of theosophy behind is relevant because the theosophist is trying to move from a being, naturally a child of his own culture and education, towards becoming a true disciple, well, ultimately of the divine instructors of infant humanity, because that's where theosophy comes from. It has been given to us as a message from, again, a fraternity of wise men, perfected spiritual men, mahatmas, adepts, elder brothers, however we wish to describe them. But they themselves, Madame Blavatsky has gone on the record, are to be regarded as such because, she says, the teaching of the divine instructors of humanity has come down to us unaltered in the hands of that esoteric tradition. And our teachers are well versed in such uninterrupted teaching. This is one of the basic things that she says. Now, because of this, a theosophist must aspire. How much actual knowledge he possesses is another matter. But he must aspire to this universality of truth. Therefore, in the first instance, the study of theosophy should make him, as it is said traditionally, that it should make a Hindu a better Hindu, a Muslim a better Muslim, a Christian a better Christian, because each tradition is illuminated by studying the depths of spiritual ideas which are implicit in it and which may not be clear at the ordinary level of popular religion. But the theosophist therefore moves on. But then what is this illumination, this direction in which he is moving? Some people have thought that it's a question of out-of-the-way knowledge, peculiar occult information, and so on. This is not the fact. Of course, extraordinary knowledge is indicated. Extraordinary knowledge is available first from study and later from inner development. But Madame Blavatsky never intended, and the Theosophical movement never intended, that we should produce shoals of magicians and adepts and so on. And in fact, she was rather discouraging about people wanting to be occultists. A reference was made in the preliminary remarks to the difference between being a theosophist and being an occultist. There's a very important statement about this, which comes very early in the beginning of the article called Practical Occultism, reprinted in the book Raja Yoga. It is easy to become a theosophist. We'll have something to say about that easy later on. She does say, it's easy to become a theosophist. Any person of average intellectual capacities and a leaning toward the metaphysical, of pure, unselfish life, who finds more joy in helping his neighbor than in receiving help himself, one who is ever ready to sacrifice his own pleasures for the sake of other people, and who loves truth, goodness, and wisdom for their own sake, not for the benefit they may confer, is a theosophist. She said, this is easy. Possibly because of Kali Yuga and the century which has passed since HBB's time. For many of us, this may not be so easy. But she's right in one way. It's very easy to respond to this. Unless there's something fundamentally wrong with one's psychology, unless you have a psychiatric problem, when you read this, look out and see, don't we want to be like that? Whether we are or not is another mad question. But anybody who's not got something psychiatrically wrong with him will want to be like this. This appeals to us as an image of what human beings should be like. And she said, this is easy, relatively, become a theosophist. And then she says, but it's quite another matter to put oneself upon the path which leads to the knowledge of what is good to do, as to the right discrimination of good from evil. A path which also leads a man to that power through which he can do the good he desires, often without even apparently lifting a finger. That is something else. That is the adept, the sage, the yogi. So, that's why she makes the distinction. But that first paragraph has a simple and touching quality which will serve us instead of any rigid definition. It shows a direction. How far anyone gets on that road at a particular point of time is another story. Now, it is this idea that she has really elaborated in her books and teachings. We said earlier that we might ask about the theosophies the same sort of questions that Arjuna asked. What does the sage, what may he declare, what does he say, what may he declare, meaning what does he say, where does he dwell, does he move and act like other men? Now the answers to all those questions are really in two places. One is a short article, it was a letter originally, called Some Words on Daily Life, written by one of the masters of wisdom. And the other place, of course, familiar to all students, is section 12, What is Practical Theosophy, in the book The Key to Theosophy. Now, in the master's letter, there are some very striking things for us. Look. He says, theosophy expects and demands. He doesn't say I do or any teachers. Theosophy, the nature of the thing. Theosophy expects and demands from the fellows of the society a great mutual toleration and charity for each other's shortcomings. He expects the shortcomings to be there. A great mutual toleration and charity for each other's shortcomings. Ungrudging mutual help in the search for truths in every department of nature, moral and physical. And this ethical standard must be unflinchingly applied to daily life. That's put in a rather formal way. I keep on saying 19th century English because now this is not how we would naturally write or speak, although it's perfectly straightforward as far as the wording or the grammar goes. But see what it means. It means that in your day-to-day relationships with people, you must apply unflinchingly, without getting nervous or without trying to dodge, the rule about charity for each other's shortcomings and ungrudging help in the search for truths in every department of nature. To put it too crudely perhaps, but concretely, if some other student is trying to understand this, then you must make the time, if you can help, to explain or to find the necessary references and books, to lend them if they are not easy to get, or to say this is where they are available. Don't say I'm too busy. You might be very busy. But the master said, you must apply this standard unflinchingly to daily life. So the formal phrase, this ethical standard must be unflinchingly applied, etc. He's not saying anything remote and complicated. What he's saying is, you must do this you must do this day to day in dealing with those actual people who are with you as other students of theosophy, and they have their shortcomings. They are not going to be wonderful people. Don't assume that they have to be. But you treat them like this. And of course, with great mutual toleration. The mutual is interesting too. It's not only that you have to be tolerant about their shortcomings. Please remember that they probably have to be tolerant about some of your shortcomings too. The word mutual is very interesting. And but in the search for truth, it doesn't tell you, doesn't say anything about what you do if they want to go and watch a cricket match, etc. That is your personal affair, and you help them about that or not. But if it comes to the search for truth, you must. That's what it amounts to. And he goes on, theosophy should not represent merely a collection of moral verities, a bundle of metaphysical ethics epitomized in theoretical dissertations. Theosophy must be made practical. And it has therefore to be disencumbered of useless digressions in the sense of desultory orations and fine talk. And then, being a master of wisdom, he adds something which we either take on trust from him or not. He says, let every theosophist only do his duty, that which he can and ought to do, and very soon the sum of human misery within and around the areas of every branch of your society will be found visibly diminished. Right. And then, of course, he adds what is a principle of the psychology of spiritual discipline. Forget self in working for others, and the task will become an easy and a light one for you. Now, mind you, that task is not in itself an easy or a light one. There is a place where HPB says that of all the things a human being can undertake, becoming an adept, that's to say a spiritually disciplined and perfected person, is one of the most difficult things you can undertake. But the adept himself says, forget self in working for others, and the task will become an easy and a light one for you. Putting those two together is one of the problems of the theosophist. It's simply that they are true. They are even very helpful. But you have to put them together, which can't be done entirely on the level of word and argument. Now, we said we're going to ask the same kind of questions about the theosophist that Arjuna was asking about the Sthita Prajna. Now, we might also ask, what we've been looking at gives us some idea of what the true theosophist, so to speak, the ideal theosophist, how he would think, what would be his approach, what would be his basic aspiration, what would he speak. Now, that has two aspects. One is, as just translated, what would he declare, what would he tell other people? He would certainly want to tell them of the great tradition of spiritual knowledge from which he has benefited. Mr. Crosby puts it very simply by saying, theosophy has helped me, it'll help you. Mr. Crosby represents his friends and fellow workers as saying this sort of thing to the newcomer or the outsider. Judge, in a memorable article in one place, says that without even meeting people, if this is what you really have faith in, then in the silent watches of the night, your mind will, as it were, go out in ripples of communication and say to people, and mind you, people you never met, but will say to them, as it were, theosophy, help and hope for thee. That's the point. Help and hope for you. That is what we're offering. We're not saying, now, have you studied theosophy? If not, why not? If you have not studied theosophy, you are destined for a bad place. Oh no, we're not saying any of those things. We're only putting forward the experience that it has helped us. And Mr. Crosby said that, it helps me to help other people. It will do the same for you. See for yourself. Now, this is one aspect of what the theosophist may declare. But there's also, of course, the simple meaning of what they speak. How does a theosophist speak? Well, there are many things we can say. In our devotional reading today, we had certain things. You remember that Krishna describes the kind of person he regards as his devotee. And in that he says two very interesting things. He also is my beloved, of whom mankind is not afraid, and who has no fear of man. This fearless relationship both ways. You are not afraid of anyone, and you don't cause anyone else to become afraid. That is one. Therefore, his speech has that quality. Then he later on says, he is of little speech. Now, the speech of somebody is a very crucial and intimate part of him. Not its superficial qualities. Not a question of whether it is polished, up to date, all those things, or accent, not those things. But there's a sense in which the speech is the man himself. Just as the Logos, the Shabda Brahman, is the divine reality as it manifests. So that the ancient tradition about the sacredness of speech is not just a mystical or sentimental thing. It is the expression of a truth, an important relationship between that which is, in the sense of is without changing, is without doing anything or action, and the action which emanates from it. The word emanate has philosophical difficulties, but don't let's worry about that. Now this is there in every philosophy that recognizes something transcendent. Because it always has to explain the relation between the transcendent and the actual visible world. And there is always something, the Greeks called it the Logos, which is just the Greek word for word. We speak in India of Shabda Brahman. But what the Logos is to God, the speech of a person is to him as he is now. So how a man speaks is very important. And in the section on what is practical theosophy, among the obvious things, and of course we all know how the Buddha speaks of the kind of speech that gives calm or gives peace to the listener and so on. Among the most specific directions, HPB says that the theosophist himself does not say things in denigration, in criticism or dispraise of other people behind their backs. What's more, if somebody says them in his presence, he protests at once. Suppose he happens to know that the unkind, the critical thing said is true, he keeps silent. He does not join in the chorus of condemnation. Even if he knows that it's true, he keeps silent. So this, now that is in the Gita, as you know, not speaking of the faults of others. That's in the Gita, specifically. Obviously, Krishna knew all about the faults of others. It's not that they don't have them. Not speaking of them, because by speaking, you do something. There is an aspect to this which is perhaps not exactly part of today's subject, but it's there in the secret doctrine. she says that at higher levels, actual disciples are not permitted to speak in so many words of certain historical events. Historical events, but which were of the nature of something unfortunate or disastrous or, you know, calamities. Because by speaking of them, they might awaken in the invisible realms certain invisible powers and forces which might tend to bring back a repetition of such. You might awaken impressions which were lying dormant. They might react on present minds in various ways, which of course it would take a practical occultist to deal with. You might awaken. Don't talk about it. We can see the same logic in Krishna saying, not speaking of the faults of others, of HPB making those rules about speech. She goes on for quite more than a whole page about it in the Key to Theosophy. Then there is this about speaking. Judge gives that advice in more than one place. Speaking in the simplest way possible. And this, in fact, theosophists have not always followed. Perhaps we don't follow it carefully enough. But just says that. He says, don't drag the unfortunate Arjunas you have captured into realms about Parabrahma and Mula Prakriti and all the rest of it. And don't use complicated Sanskrit words when simple English words would give the explanation and so on. Now, that again is precisely what the Buddha did. There were those disciples, as you know, who came to him and said, we want to sort of produce a standard or authoritative version of your teaching, and we'll put it into Chandasi Bhasha, good metrical Sanskrit. And he said, don't you do anything of the kind. He stopped them. Just go and speak to everyone you meet in whatever language they can understand. Now, but Judge has this in more than one place about how a theosophy speaks. In Mr. Crosby's Homely Hints, there is a lot about how a theosophy should treat people on a day-to-day level. It basically comes to this. It says, don't expect others to do things for you, but do for them in a nice way whatever you can. Those are practically his words. I'm not quoting exactly, but they're practically in that tone, he says. In short, have a double standard, only it's the other way around from the double standard of the world. Do what you can for other people. Don't expect them to do anything for you. Be a giver, as it were. It's like that reborn Christian who was described, who says, he is being kind to you, but he makes you feel that you are being kind to him. The whole the art, the style of human relationship is such that he doesn't give you the pressure of feeling that he's doing something for you. He does things, and he does it so with such a light touch, he doesn't let you see that he's taking trouble. So that a theosophy is supposed to have. So now, one could go on for a very long time, because after all, a theosophist may mean anything. It can mean somebody who's just an interested inquirer. It may mean somebody who's begun to do a little work for some theosophical center, a student, perhaps a worker. It can mean somebody who has begun to try to order his life outside the theosophical center, where he's away from the eyes of his fellow theosophists, where he's there in his office or business place or personal family place. But he's tried to order his life in theosophical terms. It may even be someone who's touching those stages which are discussed in articles in Raja Yoga, becoming the lay chela or even becoming the real chela of a master. Whatever that may be, we can see the direction in which he's going. And that direction is the important thing. And that in that direction, therefore, we note that he is moving from belonging to any particular traditional culture to universality in thought. He's moving in his actions and speech from being personal to being impersonal, not in a negative sense in which impersonal means sort of mechanical or rule-bound, But impersonal in the sense of beyond the limitations of personal likes and dislikes, beyond giving any regard to his own preferences. Sort of taking all human beings as they are, as human selves. And in action, he's slowly becoming not just himself, but a channel. This is a very important idea. A channel for what and whom? Not for something outside. On the contrary, he's never passive. A student of theosophy should never be passive. He should always ask and think and reconsider. But he will begin to feel that in anything real that matters, and it has happened as an actual experience to students speaking from this platform, that an explanation, an understanding, a hint of something, they have said it and realized that this is not what they could have said before they came, that this is not how their notes were, as it were, that something has arisen in the invisible exchange of sympathy and thoughts that has been going on. And just as this is true, just as they know that because of a very slight study of theosophy, they are passing on something which may be of very great use and value to the listener, which they certainly did not invent and which they don't even really understand fully, but they are enthusiastic about. They have begun to feel how important it is. They don't know it all. There are very few even among old students of this center who would say that they really know the secret doctrine and just one book. But still, I'll speak for myself. I mean, I possessed it since 1950 and I don't feel that I really know it. So that is there for... it's not that. You have the sense of being a channel. Things which have somehow become available. It's like something which St. John is supposed to have said. It's not exactly in the Bible as far as I know, but in one of the wider traditions of Christianity. He's supposed to have said, I am myself and he that sent me. That in his action, as it was somehow, it's not only him, but Christ within him, that both are acting, and there is only one outward action. Sooner or later, the student of theosophy becomes like this, but certainly from the start, if he understands what's going on, he will aspire to become like this. He will aspire not to teach, but to become a channel for the teaching to pass through. Not to speak or explain so much as to become the reed, the pipe through which the thought, the great sounds pass, because in the end it's that which is called the voice of the silence which has to speak. Time is up, and just a few minutes if somebody has some questions ready. Yes, that isn't that, as it were, what the Buddha once called, that's the whole of the life, you know. The question is, what would be the guidelines for someone who wants to live the life of the soul, to arrange his life in terms of that heavenly order? In the first place, theosophy has a very interesting comment to make. It would say, please remember that you don't have a soul. You are the soul. Sometimes these things make a small difference. I mean, it's not untrue that we have a soul. But if we say that, we're talking as if we are the present outward personality and somehow we possess a soul. It's the other way around. The soul is the real being, the individual, the permanent reality, which possesses what we call myself, as a kind of temporary apparatus. Light on the Path said that it is something which the soul has created with effort and pain as a subject for grave experiment. So it is like the apparatus which you use in the laboratory to find out something. That's what our personalities are for. So the first thing is, yes, you want to live the life of the soul. Excellent. Please remember that you are the soul. Therefore, it's not far away. It's not something new that you have to acquire. It is rather something very present which we have become habituated to ignoring. So we have to learn to turn our attention around. Do the things which are necessary in the outer life, as the Gita says, do it with the body alone, the acts of the body. Do it. But remember that you are the soul. So that in one sense, to whatsoever object the inconstant mind wanders, bring it back and place it upon the spirit. That is, see the context. Somehow there is, to any legitimate action, even if it is washing your hands with soap, there is a legitimate spiritual context of how the thing relates to the life of the soul. Find out. Think about it. All the great traditions will help you. They will help you one way or the other.